Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order this morning. Today is Wednesday, the 25th day of January, 2006. Now, 8:35 a.m., present are Senator French, Senator Huggins, Senator Guest, myself, Senator Seekins, Senator Terrio will be joining us shortly. And this morning, we're going to get started with Senate Bill 10, and we have bill sponsor, Senator Guest, is with us. Senator?
Thank you, Chair Seekins, and Senator Dyson is going to try to be here this morning as well. What I'd like to do is, the bill as written is fairly complicated to get through all the different parts. What I'd like to do is just kind of do an overview of the bill and the policy issues behind it, and then open it up for testimony and questions. As we know, it seems like increasingly, I don't know if that's the case, but we have many cases in this state, especially in the area that I live in, where juveniles decide to vandalize something. And I think there has always been a reaction from the community of, what are we doing about it? How do we hold these kids accountable? And in the past, we've always looked at policies that really only deal with the civil part and how much a parent's liable or not. Most of the work that's been done the last 10 years has been on kind of the cap, and where's the cap going to be? When I started researching this issue about 3 years ago and through the process of this bill, what we found is there's really three different processes that juveniles can go through. There's an informal process with juvenile justice, there's a criminal process, and there's a civil process. And all those processes deal with the child and the parent differently when it comes to restitution. So one of the issues is that we have a system that isn't consistent between all three. And one of the things that this bill tries to do is find that consistent system and to also start holding kids, not just their parents, accountable for their actions. So what this bill does on holding everyone consistent is the following. It says that a juvenile will be liable for the first $5,000 worth of damage. I'll tell you, I chose $5,000. It was a policy call. I chose it for two reasons. The little data that we could find on the levels of vandalism, 99% of them fell under $5,000. So it seemed like a good demarcation point. And if I looked at it as in terms of how many years of dividends, it was about five, and I was like, okay, that's probably a good demarcation point. But so we chose $5,000. So the first $5,000 the child will be responsible for, the next 15 the parent will be responsible for, and that comes out of current law. So that's the current civil. They will hold parents accountable for $15,000 worth of damage. And then the child's accountable for the rest, which I know to some and many seems very harsh. If someone does $50,000 or $100,000 worth of damage. The idea behind the bill is both for parents and for children to create a payment plan, and for that payment plan to go past the age of 18. And it's under the theory that I say, if a kid is paying $50 a month for the rest of his life, I'm okay with that, because they're paying back the damage that they did. I don't want to bankrupt them or put such a heavy debt on them that they might not be able to buy a car or get a student loan or this and that. But at the same time, I think that holding kids responsible for their actions is important, and trying to do that in a reasonable way is important. In this bill, it calls for as close as we can get to saying you have to have full restitution, which is not the case in all of these processes right now. The courts have told us we can't dictate full restitution, but the language that Ms. Cook used is as close as what we have in law right now to full restitution, except if the victim is okay with not getting full restitution. And there could be a variety of reasons, but it puts it in the victim's hands, not the juvenile's hands, and not the system's hands, of deciding how much restitution. But if the victim is okay with, look, if they just pay me X, or pay over time, I'm fine with that. And then the snag in the system is that the informal process has to end when a juvenile is 18. And so if the payment can't end, it's the only place where we can't do payments after the age of 18. So if full restitution can't be done by 18, those cases will go to the civil or the criminal side versus the informal side of it. So really, I mean, like most of the things that we discuss in this building, it comes down to a matter of a lot of different policy calls that over the last 3 years I've grappled with, and I want people's feedback on. One is, how much do you hold kids accountable versus parents? And it's a difficult one. I have constituents who say the kids should pay everything, and I have constituents who say the parents should pay everything. And where do we balance who's liable? And we, at least I made the policy call, I didn't want the courts deciding who was good parents and bad parents and how much, you know, each parent should pay under different circumstances, because that's the other alternative. And I don't think we want the courts really getting into that part of the family structure in this way. The other is restitution versus accountability. It's really easy to say they have to pay it and they have to pay it all now, but then you're not going to hold the kid accountable because normally a child's not going to have the money to pay it then. So if you're going to hold the child accountable, your restitution's going to be a little slower. And that's the balance of how much do we want to ensure restitution at the time versus the deep pocket and trying to get the, and then who actually did the crime. So there's this restitution versus accountability tug between those two. And then there's the tug between bankruptcy and restitution. Do we say, yes, you have to pay it now, either to a family or to a child? The child, you're not going to get it most likely if you say you want it now. And a family could bankrupt the entire family because one child made a bad act. Those, again, are policy calls and pure policy calls. And I just tried to balance with the payment plan and telling the court system, you know, you have to create, you know, you have to look at what's affordable for that family or for that child and create a payment plan that's going to be different depending on the family circumstances. In addition, that's the meat of the bill. In addition, at the request of some other members and some other folks I talked to, there's two other issues. One, we can take all of a PFD under this bill, and we can have someone apply for a PFD. In the past, it's been 80%, and that's been just for the parents. We did do a section on driver's license response to some of my colleagues in the Senate and a judge that I talked to, saying if you really want to start holding kids accountable or having some things that they'll respond to, look at their driver's license. And in law, we've always said only DUIs do we look at driver's license for kids under 18. We don't say any crime that you commit. One of the penalties is you're not going to get your driver's license for X amount of time, or you're going to get it revoked. And so this kind of says for any crime, misdemeanor, felony, you know, the driving under 18 is a privilege, and that's a privilege that if you're not responsible for the community, we're going to take back for a while. So that kind of sums up the entire bill. I know it is, even for me, difficult to read through and figure out which part is that which, because we have these three avenues and we're changing all of them to try to make them consistent. So with that, I'll answer any questions, and I know the department's here. I don't know if they're wanting to testify or if anyone else wants to testify at this time.
Questions for the sponsor? Senator, one question I have is, okay, let's talk about the responsibility. We say child's responsible for the first $5,000, then the parent is. And we have in the bill said that legal guardians, parents of runaway or missing minors, and adoptive parents of a hard to place child are exempt from the liability. When a child is the in effect the ward of the state, is the state responsible?
Thank you. And I'm sorry, that was one of the points that I meant to hit. The state wouldn't be responsible. That was language that is in current law, and it was worked on by Senator Dyson 4 years ago, I believe, maybe our first year down here. So we kept all of that because there's a lot of work done on what do we do in these situations, especially on hard to place. all those kids would still be wards of the state, even if they're in a hard-to-place adoption, or there would be that type of relationship. So what I tried to do was keep Senator Dyson's intent 4 years ago.
Now, the reason I ask that question is this property damage could be done against a school. It could be done against an individual. And it seems to me that the individual has a right to recover against a parent for some restitution, but not against the state. And I kind of think, you know, if the state has assumed some responsibility, they also should assume some liability. That's just my particular viewpoint on it. A law that applies to a parent should also apply to the state when the child is a legal guardian or legally the responsibility of the state. And I don't know how other members feel about that, but it's just a thought in my mind.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to also have to double check on that when it comes to hard to place versus the state. Let me double check that I actually gave you right information. Mm-hmm. And I also talked to Senator Dyson about that. We just took what was in current law. I would actually agree with you. I do agree with what we did 4 years ago on hard to place and some of the other situations where we want to try to get kids into stable homes.
Right.
But let me check on the state liability and check with Senator Dyson. Okay.
Again, mine is looking at it from the property owner's standpoint of a right to recover.
And then, Mr. Chair, the difficulty is that if the child doesn't have parents or have parents that in this case have been exempt from liability, that $15,000 can't be recovered any other way, and that's just because of equal protection. So I would agree with you that that net should be narrowly cast on who's exempted.
Other questions for the sponsor? And Senator Terrio has joined us. Thank you. Senator French.
Thank you. Senator Guest, the cases that really inflame public opinion, of course, are these school vandalism cases, and they're really destructive. Everyone gets mad. They hurt your schools in my district. Usually, and I'm just asking because I just don't know, sort of the criminal justice system's power over a minor, in this case someone under 18, sort of ends about a year after 18. You can extend probation, I think a year, maybe even another one. After 18 if they've committed some crime, say vandalism. How, and I'm just curious, how does your bill sort of keep the power of a court on a minor after they become emancipated, after they become an adult, if they do, say, $100,000 worth of damage to a school and you want to make sure you have the power to continue to collect restitution from them on into adulthood?
Mr. Chair, Senator French, am I correct in that your question is if someone's 19 or 20 and they stop paying the restitution, power do we have over?
Well, let's say they're 15 when they commit the vandalism. Yeah. They do $100,000 worth of damage to a school. If they were convicted of, say, arson, the criminal justice system's power over them would expire typically a year after the age of 18, mm-hmm. and they'd be off probation. They'd be done with that criminal case. But the $100,000, I assume, would still be owing to the school district or mm-hmm. maybe someone's house if it were burned down. How does the bill maintain, you know, jurisdiction, if you will, over the now adult for the crime committed as a 15-year-old?
Through the chair, Senator French, I'm actually going to have to get back to you because as many hearings as I've been through on this and been round and round with juvenile justice and law, it hasn't come up. It's just been, okay. Yeah, we can do this payment plan after 18, and that's fine if you stay in the criminal or civil. So let me get back to actually the mechanics because I can't recite them off the top of my head.
Thank you. It was just something that occurred to me as you were presenting the bill this morning, and so thank you.
Senator, another question that I have is, and I'm not familiar with the procedure, you'll have to excuse me on this, but when someone, when the court orders restitution from an individual, and this kind of goes along with another bill I think that you're a little bit involved with, but when the court orders restitution is, I know if I win a civil suit against you, and you owe me money. That judgment is entered against you in my favor, and it's not removed until you've paid the debt. And it shows up on your credit report. Does, in the case of a restitution ordered by the court, does that show up on your credit report until such time as that restitution is satisfied? And if not, maybe this would be a good place to make sure that it did.
Mr. Chair, it is the intent of the bill, and I believe it is in the bill, that it would when the person turns 18. Mm-hmm. It follows them just like any other debts, and it would for the parent as well.
And it gets entered into a credit history record some way or
it's
another.
It's dealt with the same way that any restitution or debt.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how that happens. Does anybody on the committee know how that happens, if that does get entered somewhere in the credit history? I know it would have a direct effect on what that person would be able to finance.
Yes. I don't know, again, I don't know the process, but it's the same process for all of the debts
right. When
someone's over 18. But I'll get back to you on that.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just reviewing here the bill, and on page 8, lines 7 and 8, very simply state, the schedule must provide for payments adequate to fulfill the total restitution amount before the minor reaches 18.
Right. What happens if it doesn't?
Mr. Chair, Senator Huggins, that is for the informal action.
Right.
And so there's kind of three avenues, civil, criminal, and juvenile justice has the informal. Informal, if it can't be satisfied by 18, has to go to one of the other two actions. It's not allowed to go past 18. And right now, the informal really is, it's one where it's balancing, protecting the public, and holding accountable, and supporting the youth and development. We've sent kind of some, in my mind, some mixed goals to juvenile justice and informal. So this is trying to focus more, say, you know, you can't dismiss restitution because of other issues.
I know it makes it very difficult for someone, for an example, to finance a house if they have an open judgment on their credit report. And so it gives them some incentive to settle it, get it out of there, get the person repaid. And so that's what I'm looking at. So we'll look into that too.
And
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is sort of back in the realm of pure policy, but I just can't help but ask the question because I'm sure you thought about it. You can imagine cases where a youth is just completely responsible for whatever he or she did. I mean, they just went out on their own and did something no one could have predicted, and they caused a lot of damage. You can imagine cases where an adult either encouraged or through their total negligence allowed a child to play with matches and burn a house down that now most of us would say the adult's totally responsible. And I'm sure you thought about this, but why not just sort of give the court the authority and indeed command the court to order full restitution and to let the court apportion it between the youth and the parents as the court sees fit, according to the facts of the case?
Through the chair, Senator French, I did, and I think I struggled with it. And I think the extremes are the easy cases. The other ones are the gray cases. And I guess I made the policy call of putting some structure to it versus having the courts determine how good or bad or negligent a parent was, because most of the cases are gray. Well, what was your 16-year-old doing out at 10 o'clock at night? And who's going to judge whether or not you were being responsible or irresponsible as a parent and therefore should pay more? I also think it will probably go more towards deep pockets and looking at the case of the situation, the family situation versus the accountability. So it is difficult because you could have a 5-year-old who, you know, is given matches at a play yard. And it's dealt with the same way as a 16-year-old who's out with friends and decides to trash a schoolyard. And if folks in the committee want to work on a different avenue, I'm definitely willing to have that conversation. It's one that I've grappled with. It's the trade-off. And it's the trade-off of, is that a role that we want the courts to play now? And what kind of guidance, if any, on us saying what is a good parent and not a good parent. And I guess I wasn't comfortable in trying to put those sideboards on. I was more comfortable in trying to create some structure around it. But it's a valid, I think, policy avenue. It's just a difficult one, and it's difficult to figure out how the courts would interpret that and make decisions. And then will there be inequities on how they see different parents different ways? And so it was pure policy.
Right.
Other questions? I sometimes struggle with the when we as a state want to hold parents responsible, and I think that there is a certain level of responsibility on the part of parents for the actions of their minor children. I try to balance between what authority we give to parents to be able to discipline their children and to control their children versus what level of responsibility we want to hold them to. There are times I remember when I was growing up, parental authority had a lot more sting to it than it may today in many cases. I know I was in more trouble at home when I got there than I was at school if I did something wrong. And today some of that is missing, regrettably. But I think this strikes some kind of a balance here where parents should try to control the activities of their children. And it does puzzle me sometimes when I'm been out late to a meeting somewhere and come home and in Fairbanks at 1 or 2 in the morning, it's still light outside, and you see minor children riding down the street on their bicycles. And I wonder where the parents are. Leave kids, there's two things that get kids in trouble, spare time and spare money. And when these kids have nothing else to do, their minds get active and they can get in trouble. And so sometimes I was probably pretty lucky I didn't get caught doing some of the things I did when I was a kid. That parental responsibility versus parental authority is a question that always bounces around inside my mind.
And Mr. Chair, has been a comment of many people since I've been working on this bill. Mm-hmm. Again, everyone I think has, it seems like many people have very strong opinions. Mm-hmm. On one way or the other. So it was trying to balance that.
Other questions from the members? If not, we'll move to public testimony. Do we have anyone here today that would like to testify on this bill? Sir? If you'd come up and put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
My name is Tony Newman. I'm a program officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. And I wanted to say that we appreciate any efforts to enhance the ability of victims to get the restitution they're due because of juvenile crime. We've also appreciated the questions and updates we've received from Senator Guess's office as she and her staff crafted this bill. We do have some concerns about the bill. The most significant of our concerns are related to those sections devoted to the changes in the apportioning of restitution between parents and juveniles, and the sections related to revocations of driver's licenses. This bill, as Senator Guest mentioned, creates a payment scheme for civil damages and formally ordered court restitutions that has youth solely responsible for damages up to $5,000 and parents liable for the next $15,000. Placing significant portions of civil and formal court restitution responsibility solely on youths, our concern is may decrease rather than increase the likelihood that those will be repaid if you take out the parents' responsibility to help contribute to the restitution. So these are important questions for the committee to consider. Would an expensive restitution be more likely to be repaid if you take out the parents' role in paying a part of that? Would it saddle a youth with a debt that is that they could never repay on their own, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage? That said, the more significant concern for us are those related to the driver's license revocation pieces. Expanding the loss of a license to any misdemeanor or felony, as the bill would have, in our view, is instituting a pretty wide-ranging punishment for offenses in a way that may not be associated with the type or level of offense or the youth's risks and needs. Committing vandalism that is in no way related to driving might not be best addressed by taking one's driver's license away. If the idea is that revoking a driver's license would work as a deterrent to future property crime, we're unaware of any evidence that shows juveniles are less likely to commit property damages if they know their driver's license would be revoked. The division has been spending the last few years investing heavily and looking real closely at the factors linked to delinquent behavior. We've adopted a new assessment tool that we believe will help us do a much better job of helping us target resources and responses toward crime, toward those youth with the highest likelihood of reoffense, and help us get away from taking measures which may sound effective but which really don't get at the heart of the reasons why kids commit crimes, and that will help them keep them from offending again. I note that the bill does contain an exemption for getting your license revoked if you need to drive to work. The bill says there's an exception if you need to drive to work that the judge can reconsider revocation of the license. But our concern is this isn't just work that kids need to get to. They also need, if they're going to respond well to the sanctions and to the incentives that we've given them in the juvenile justice system, they need to get to their appointments with their probation officers. They may need to get to counseling appointments with their families. Driving is a privilege. It's also a necessity in this day and age. Ultimately, we're concerned that revoking driver's licenses for any misdemeanor or felony related to vandalism or not might not only be punitive, it can hurt the youth's chances of avoiding future delinquent activity. Those were my thoughts on the bill, and
questions.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Newman. Senator French.
Mr. Newman, what level of sort of conviction, if you will, is required to pull the driver's license? Does there have to be a formal adjudication as a delinquent, or can the license be pulled, say, through an informal?
In this bill, it can be pulled for an informal, or it must be pulled for an informal or formal case, I believe.
Administratively or judicially here?
Both.
So an informal adjudication pulls a license the same as a formal adjudication?
I believe so.
Everyone's nodding their heads yes, like that's, thank you.
Senator Guest, is this a discretionary action on the part of the courts, or is it a mandatory action?
Mr. Chair, as written now, it's a mandatory action.
Okay. Senator French.
Mr. Newman, maybe for the members of the committee that aren't as familiar with the juvenile justice system as you are, could you describe the different steps required to go through both an informal and then a formal adjudication?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, when a youth breaks the law, when the youth commits a vandalism, the police will forward the report on that crime to a juvenile justice intake officer, a probation officer anywhere around the state. That officer will look at factors about the crime, about the amount of damages done, about a preliminary investigation of the youth's risks and needs, family situation, and based on those factors make the determination whether or not to forward that to a court, to petition the court, or to handle it informally. In the case of an informal, handling it informally, that means calling up the parent and the child and saying, would you come in for an interview and discussion about this? They'll do that when a restitution is when a damage is relatively low in value, and give the youth and the parent the opportunity to handle this outside the court. And in many cases, the parent and youth will say, we are happy to avoid a court appearance. We will pay. And then the youth and the parent will work that out on their own, how that gets paid up. In terms of our job doing gathering restitutions in informal cases, we have I went and looked at the that is a performance measure of how are we doing in gathering restitutions on informal cases. In fiscal year 05, we gathered some 97% of those restitutions we'd ordered informally before case closure. Before a case closed, we'd gather those. And as Senator Guest said, those are typically $100, $200. When we're getting into the $1,000 range, we're far more likely to take that into a formal level to ensure that restitution gets repaid.
If you could just tell us a little bit more about the procedure involved in going through a formal adjudication, the court procedures and the rights afforded to the minor and so forth.
The intake officer who has the police referral petitions the court, writes up a petition and sends it to the court, and the court brings the juvenile in. And the court orders restitution at that point. And since about 2003, we have had an arrangement with the Department of Law. The Department of Law has started a collections unit that is now responsible for seeing that all restitutions ordered through the formal court process are paid. At that point, it becomes out of the juvenile probation officer's responsibility to gather it. And in fact, we are not tracking how many restitutions and how much restitution is paid through the formal court process because, the Department of Law has a collections unit now that sort of functions like a bill collection service, and they're responsible for seeing that those restitutions get paid.
But if I may, Mr. Going back to the legal steps involved, a minor will be given an attorney or provided with an attorney prior to a formal court adjudication.
Correct.
I assume they'll have the opportunity to contest the charges if they the minor thinks he or she can prove their innocence. They're given the opportunity to do so. You know, it's a case of mistaken identity or, a case of, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, kind of thing.
True. Through the chair, the delinquency process is different from the adult process in that youth are not convicted of specific charges. They are either adjudicated delinquent or not adjudicated delinquent. And that's just as much based on their history, their family circumstances, their behavior, their attitude, their school performance, all those factors put together as much as it is a specific crime. So it's very rare that we actually go to trial with a juvenile who's contesting that they've been charged with anything. The reason for that is because often before we go to court, a youth will have a long history of informal charges. And recognizing that the informal process has not worked, we then proceed to court. There's little benefit in contesting that they're not a delinquent at that point when they've got this long history. It's very difficult to argue that they, in fact, aren't a delinquent when we have a long record of, an often long record. In the case of a serious offense through which a juvenile doesn't have that long history, there is much more advantage for a juvenile to go through the formal process in the juvenile system than to be waived to the adult court or to contest their charges and go through a trial. It's just a longer, more difficult process.
One more, thank you. Maybe I haven't asked my question very artfully, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is, what legal trigger is there if this bill will pull a minor's driver's license? And I think it's a great tool. It sounds like a really great tool to control young people. They love their cars more than anything else. So it's going to be very useful, I think, in the right setting. But I just want to know if an intake officer reads a police report that says that a minor was charged with shoplifting something out of the car's grocery store, that if that intake officer finds there's probable cause to believe that that crime took place, he goes through the informal adjudication process. Is that what will trigger the pulling of the licenses? Is that one single officer's decision that there's probable cause to support the charge?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to correct the record, and I didn't want to interrupt, but it's only in the adjudicated in the bill. It's not in the informal.
Thank you very much.
We were double checking that because I was like, I thought it was just in the adjudicated, and it's just in the adjudicated process.
The formal process,
not in the informal. So hopefully the smaller ones, I think that's appropriate.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Newman? Thank you very much, Mr. Newman. Appreciate your being here with us this morning. Just in terms of procedure, so that other people know, in the Judiciary Committee, we have several assumptions in our procedure. We assume, first of all, that decorum is of the highest order, and we do a very good job at that in the Judiciary Committee. I also assume that all questions are answered and asked through the chair, and it isn't necessary for us to repeat that on a basis, but we also understand that the clerk over there, for the record, needs to have your names as we do our discussion. So, I will try to keep up with all the members and recognize who is speaking for the record, and then. But this is a very good committee in terms of its decorum, and and we encourage active discussion. So I'm going to assume some of those things so that nobody always has to, the questions and answers don't have to always come through the chair. I'm assuming that they are, if that's agreeable with the rest of the members of the committee. And so do we have someone else that wants to testify on this bill this morning? Seeing none, do we have anyone else online? No one online? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to carry this bill over. There are several questions that we need to address and answer. I appreciate the bill being here. It looks like it's a very interesting bill, and I'm sure we'll get some more discussion as we come to the closing discussion on this bill. So we'll just take about a three-minute recess, and we'll come back in about 3 minutes for the next bill. And that will be, let me take a look here, allow you to get set up, House Bill 101. So we're recess. Okay, we reconvened, and we're now moving on to House Bill number 101, and the sponsor is with us, Representative Croft. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your introduction this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative Eric Croft, and I represent Spinard in the Alaska Legislature. My pleasure, and I appreciate you hearing HB 101 today. I'd like to start with a description of the problem that we face, and then some discussion about what we can do about it, the mechanics of the bill, and some of the distinctions between it and a bill you will hear later on today or later on in this session on human trafficking. One of the best descriptions of the problem we face is from a statement, a speech by President George W. Bush to the United Nations General Assembly on September 23, 2003. He says, "There's another humanitarian crisis spreading, yet hidden from view. Each year, human beings are bought, sold, or forced across the world's borders. Among them are hundreds of thousands of teenage girls and others as young as five who fall victim to the sex trade. This commerce in human life generates billions of dollars each year, much of which is used to finance organized crime. There's a special evil in the abuse and exploitation of the most innocent and vulnerable. The victims of the sex trade see little of life before they see the very worst of life, an underground of brutality and lonely fear. Those who create these victims and profit from their suffering must be severely punished. Those who patronize this industry debase themselves and deepen the misery of others, and governments that tolerate this trade are tolerating a form of slavery. This problem has appeared in my own country, and we are working to stop it. The PROTECT Act, which I signed into law this year," George Bush speaking, "makes it a crime for any person to enter the United States or for any citizen to travel abroad for the purpose of sex tourism involving children. The Department of Justice is actively investigating sex tour operators and patrons who can face up to 30 years in prison. Under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, the United States is using its sanctions against governments to discourage human trafficking." And then very briefly on following that, there was a Department of State report on this issue. It was published in June of 2004, a report called Trafficking in Persons. And briefly from it, "The commercial sexual exploitation of children affects millions of children each year in countries on every continent. One form of this exploitation is the growing phenomena of child sex tourism, persons who travel from their own country to a foreign country to engage in a commercial sex act with a child commit CST, as they refer to it here. Crime is fueled by weak law enforcement, the internet, ease of travel, and poverty. And they mentioned the United States strengthening its laws. This is a horrible problem, and the question, I think, is what can we do about it? The first and most important step was the federal law that President Bush referred to that makes it a crime to travel for the purposes of sex with a child. But we can also act as states. And Hawaii, I think the problem, while it's a global problem and affects every state, maybe we have a special exposure to it being on the Pacific Rim, and Hawaii, at the lead of that, maybe had a special emphasis on it. They passed a law very similar to the one you're considering today, making it illegal to advertise those sorts of tourism for prostitution purposes. And the Hawaii legislature, when they passed it, in their findings, said the legislature finds that the sex industry has rapidly expanded over the past several decades and involves sexual exploitation of persons, predominantly women and girls, including activities related to prostitution, pornography, sex tourism, and other commercial sex acts. Prostitution and related activities, which are inherently harmful and dehumanizing, contribute to the trafficking in persons, as does sex tourism. The low status of women in many parts of the world has led to a burgeoning of the trafficking industry. Discouraging sex tourism, which is an estimated $1 billion per year business worldwide, is key to reducing the demand for sex trafficking worldwide. Under their new law, they were able to prosecute and withdraw the license from a Honolulu travel agency that had placed explicit advertisements on a web for the ultimate Asian sex tour of Thailand. And I would hope that Alaska, with this bill, would have that same power to both prosecute people who do this and withdraw the license of operators who do it. So there's a specific criminal justice thing we can do, and that's important. That is having the ability to prosecute people who advertise this in our state. But as important, I think, is the message it sends of public condemnation of this conduct. We're passing a real law with real consequences, but we're also making a statement here about how we feel about this activity. And that's why I think you've had broad support from the religious community that has made this an issue. Many different churches have taken on this issue courageously, I believe. On somewhat of the mechanics of the bill, you have before you HB 101. Representative Kurtula has HB 148. My original version of the bill, and I think we've cleaned up all the descriptions of it, but occasionally still we refer to that original version, or some of the people who send in letters in support refer to the original version, had both the advertising of tourism element and the human trafficking element, if you will, the activity that occurs someplace else and how they advertise it here, or the activity that might occur in this state when they forcibly bring people here for purposes of prostitution. After Representative Kurtula introduced her bill, I bifurcated those. That had been the focus of hers, and the bill before you solely concentrates on the advertising of those sex tours here and prohibits it. You have a version before you passed by the House. In addition, late last year, the Department of Law submitted a proposed substitute, and I think it has some merit, so I wanted to put it before the committee. I'm not wedded to the particular language that we drafted in the House. I would like any version that does what we would like. And
so now, which version passed the House? Is that, that's just for the record?
Right. You have HB 101 Judiciary Amended. It's F.A.
F.A.
Yeah. And it's somewhat longer, and it uses, Mr. Chairman, the operative language. Both establish a C felony for this conduct. I think the operative language to concentrate on is in the original version, the House version, sells, advertises, or otherwise offers to sell travel services or facilitates travel for the purpose of another person engaging in an act which would be, or for the purpose of engaging in an act that would be commercial sex. What I intended is to get those that advertise this conduct, but not sweep in Thai Air, who facilitates travel but doesn't know what the purpose is. That is, an airline that flies somebody to Thailand is providing travel services, and maybe providing travel services for the purpose of, if we inartfully define it. But if they don't know and are not doing it as an enticement or not advertising commercial sex as the reason for the tour, and if they have no way of knowing that that's why that passenger is flying, I don't believe it's fair, nor did I intend that they be caught up in it. The operative language that the Department of Law suggested is promotes or facilitates travel that includes commercial sex conduct as enticement for the travel. And that may very well be more precise language and preferable language. My concern, and the reason we didn't adopt it, was both the lateness of the session last year, and I don't want to be too narrow either. I've watched this committee before. You guys do good and thorough work, so I just wanted to put it before you. That's fine as long as we cast the net that catches all that we want to and not significantly more than we want to.
So the draft that we have before us from the Department of Law, which is at this point is called Draft A, basically is a substitute for the entire language of the bill.
Right. And as I said, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a particular pride of ownership on the particular words. I want words that will express the public condemnation that we want to do and will allow prosecutions of those that are doing this and not catch anyone else that is doing innocent travel services and they have no way of knowing that that's the reason the person is traveling.
So do you support the draft A, or would you prefer to retain your current language and make any modifications to it?
Well, unless you really want to force me into preference, I really did prefer to put it before you as an alternative. I am perfectly fine with either version and was looking forward to the discussion here on which would be preferred.
We don't force anybody to support anything over here.
Well, okay. I'm not sure I had the power even if I wanted to.
Right.
We have somebody from the Department of Law today.
Yeah, we'll get to the Department of Law in a moment. Do we have someone here from the Department of Law this morning? No, I don't see anybody.
I didn't bring it. I brought her Annie Carpinetti's draft, but
you want to see if they want to have somebody come over? Was Annie coming?
So I don't know.
Oh, okay. Didn't play. Flight didn't make it. All right. Well, we'll have plenty of time to get it. We'll just we're going to talk about these two bills this morning, and then we'll have time.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate the committee's time and you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing it.
Questions of the sponsor? Seeing none? Okay, Senator Huggins.
Representative Carl, thank you very much. Charlie Huggins. I don't live in Spinard. I've driven through there a few times. I'm not sure in Wasilla this is a major problem for us, but I would. What was the order of magnitude of difficulty that might be in your district?
Well, the Spinard has had a reputation during the pipeline years in that regard. I think we've cleaned up our act some, Senator Huggins, but this is a global problem, and we know that it's significant. We know that it's over $1 billion a year globally. This bill is addressing what do we do about advertising that conduct and somebody flying to Vietnam or Thailand or wherever for commercial sex. The bill you're going to hear in a second talks about what do we do about people who traffic in persons and bring them here to the state. So this bill deals with the international sex trade. But even that, it's hard to quantify. We can know it's big, and we know it's advertised. We're not really sure how. A lot on the internet, some in sort of personal columns. However it's advertised, I wanted to make the statement and give the prosecution, give the state the tools to very clearly say we're not going to allow it here. The question was brought up in House Judiciary, or House Finance, I guess. Well, what if it's legal in the other nation? Should we or can we make illegal the advertising of something that is legal elsewhere? And in particular, they brought up the Mustang Ranch idea of if somebody's advertising here for not just international, but something that is legal in a state of this nation. And after some discussion, I just finally said, I don't care about the legal status in some other country or even some other state. I don't want you to advertise it here. I'm not going to lower our standards to the lowest denominator of the world or the nation. We have decided it's illegal here, and we are not going to let you advertise it or advertise travel for it. Sort of ran around your question.
But yeah, thanks.
Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, follow up for just, I guess, comment. I think, you know, Senator Terrio has been, you mentioned Vietnam and Thailand. I may be one of the few people here that was in that neck of the woods once upon a time, not by invitation, I might add, but because of advertisement. My father spent a long time in Thailand. My point, though, is I was there way back in the 60s, 70s time frame. I've been back since. It's amazing to me the maturation of the sex industry there and how perverted it is in some cases and the communicable aspect in another that's came with that maturation in Vietnam as just a counterpart to that. It scares me to think about the implication of that on our country, but more specifically to our state and our communities. And I thank you for what you're doing.
Senator Guest.
Thank you. Representative Croft, you brought up the internet. Can you walk through how either version of the bill, but the concept of, I'm guessing that this only goes to Alaska businesses. So if Alaska business is advertising over the internet, then we can go out after them. But if it's a Nebraska company, we as the state of Alaska can't. Can you just discuss that versus maybe advertising in the newspaper if it is Alaska company, not an Alaska company?
We thank you through the chair, Senator Guest. We got farther than I want to get into the legalities of what you can and can't do on regulating the internet. And after a long time in that thicket, sort of pulled back, we can talk about what our citizens and our businesses can advertise or can't advertise in papers, on the internet, through whatever vehicle. So we can say, you, Alaska citizen or business, may not do these things. And the vehicle they use could be many different ones. And I think that's the safest place. That's where Hawaii stayed, and I think that's where we're on the firmest legal ground. When I try and change, regulate, modify what's on the internet, you get into some very difficult areas of preemption that I still don't, after looking at it some time, know that I can adequately summarize for you. But Hawaii did, and I feel sure we can say, you, Alaska person or business, may not advertise through whatever means this sort of a tour, this sort of conduct. And the Hawaii prosecution was for them advertising on the internet, just as easily if they put an ad in the press or some other vehicle. So long answer or short answer to a long, complicated area, I don't quite know what we can do in the whole area of internet regulation, but I feel comfortable we can for our citizens and our businesses enact this law and it have the teeth that we want.
Go ahead, Senator Guest.
Representative Croft, then what happens if it's a Nebraska business advertising in Alaska? Do we then have to look to Nebraska to prosecute? And I guess the same thing is, what if Alaska business is advertising outside of Alaska?
Second part is, Mr. Chairman, Senator Guest, the second part is easier than the first. I think our businesses and people advertising through whatever, you know, where is the internet located? It's hard to say. But we definitely can, and the Hawaii is a good example of them advertising elsewhere if it means that advertisement is seen in Alaska. And that's the trick on the internet. If an Alaska company advertising in a solely Kansas publication I don't know whether we'd be able to, and I don't know that we would be able to jail a Nebraska citizen for advertising up here. I don't know.
Through the Mr. Chair, if I...
You just let me know when you're done with your line of questioning. Okay.
She's tough.
She is.
No, it's just an interesting one of, you know, if I wanted to then do this business, I would just locate in one state and advertise in another, and neither state could get at me. And it doesn't seem like that's the purpose or the intent of any of the bills that are going on in any of the states. So I was trying to figure out how, and we won't even get into the overseas issue of right. who's advertising. But so that's maybe you can think about it and get back to me. If we have a law and Nebraska has a law, can I just locate my business in Nebraska and advertise in Alaska and locate my business in Alaska and advertise in Nebraska and flip-flop and not ever have to worry about falling under any of these laws? Maybe someone else. Maybe it's just me that's confused.
I think it's a good question.
It's a good
and
question.
I don't know the answer.
Senator French?
I'll hazard an educated guess, and I'll just it's off the top of my head, but I think that if you could go to an Alaska judge and say, here's an advertisement for sex tourism, and it's been put in an Alaska newspaper or put in front of Alaska viewers in some other way, and I can identify who this person is or businesses that committed the crime, that judge would issue a warrant under this statute. And then it would be up to, you know, the processes of the law to reach out and grab that person that committed that crime and bring them to Alaska to stand justice. I don't think you can commit a crime in the state, stand just outside the border of the state, and you know, thumb your nose at the authorities. So my guess is that an Alaska judge would give you a warrant under the statute for a crime committed here in the state. That is, the crime is selling or advertising here in the state. Now, if you live here and do it somewhere else, that's a tougher question, but if crime happens here, you can go get the person and bring them here and make them stand justice. That's my guess.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Croft, when I thought about this, the most complicated scenario in my mind was one if this was a floating thing, like a cruise ship. Did you give any thought to that, the implications?
The conduct happening on the cruise ship?
Well, the advertisement? The advertisement to cause it to happen, the location.
I didn't give it. That's why Senate Judiciary has its well-earned reputation. No, I do recall cases that we've had since in my term in the legislature over the last 10 years where we've clarified our jurisdiction in territorial waters for crimes committed there. So a brochure on a cruise ship, if it's outside of 3 miles, I don't know, but inside of 3 miles, I think that is conduct within United States or within Alaska state jurisdiction, and that we have done some tweaking in the past to make sure that crimes that happen even on the water, there was a rape case on a ferry where we wanted to make sure that we had jurisdiction. So I believe we'd have jurisdiction for the advertisement occurring if it were in Alaska water.
Okay. So if it was advertised in Washington state, the point of departure was Bellingham.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, appeared to me to be the most challenging scenario to come to grips with.
Probably is.
No, I believe you're probably correct that if it's in our waters, it's in our jurisdiction. Do you have an example that currently has taken place, Representative, of an act that would break this law in the state of Alaska?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't have one in the state of Alaska. We have the Hawaii example, and we know this goes on. You know, there's no question that it's a huge and growing problem in the third world. There's no question that there are significant amounts of U.S. citizens and Alaska citizens who go there. Identifying exactly who or how it's advertised is very difficult. It's a sort of underground deal. We have found internet sites that point you on how to go and where to go. But so you can look at the supply side, if you will, and know there's a significant amount of people doing this. Identifying which ones and how many are from Alaska versus California, just very difficult.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Cross.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Wagner, I see you're signed up. Are you going to testify on the following bill as well?
Yes, sir. I've been waiting until the second bill or this one now.
Your option, if you would like to testify on both at one time or if you would want to split it up, I'll leave it up to you, sir.
I'm going to testify on both bills together.
Okay. Why don't we do that at the conclusion of the introduction of the next bill then? All right, thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill in the audience this morning? Anyone online? No? Okay, we'll move on. And Representative Catula, you can get up here and get ready while we introduce your bill, House Bill 148, Trafficking of Persons. And we have the sponsor with us, Representative Beth Catula. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary this morning, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we're eager to hear your presentation.
Thanks. It's great to be here this morning, and I really thank you for hearing the bill. I'm going to be a little brief this morning because there are people, I think maybe even online, who wanted to testify. But as Representative Croft has already outlined, human trafficking is a particularly horrendous crime against people. It's our modern-day version of slavery, and it is a global problem. But unfortunately, we also have the problem here in Alaska. We had the first case brought under the federal anti-trafficking law, and we have instances. Once we introduced this legislation, unfortunately, I started finding out about more instances of it, and it is continuing to occur right here in our own state. President Bush and the federal government have encouraged the states to enact their own laws so that we too can participate in stopping this horrible crime and in working with the victims of it. You have, I think this morning, an outline and a statement from Professor Basu from the University of Washington. And I'll just refer you to it when you have time to read it. In it, she outlines her own personal experience in working with trafficking in Washington State, our neighbor, and the very deep sadness of working with the victims of this horrible crime. HB 148 has been crafted with the Department of Law. It took a lot of work to get it here, but we are really open and hoping for any advice or thoughts from your committee on making it even better. I feel like our law right at the moment is pretty clean in comparison to the other states who have sought to criminalize this activity. The jurisdictional question, I will say, is easier than Representative Croft's in the sense that his is taking the great step of stopping activity that will happen someplace else, where ours is a typical Alaska crime. The activity has to happen here. It's bringing mostly, it turns out to be, women and young children into the state, forcing them into forced labor or sexual activity. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions, and I don't want to minimize the seriousness of the problem, but because there are other people who are here to testify today, I'll hold back and let them do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for the sponsor this morning? Seeing none.
I'm sure there might be later, so we'll be available, and I'll let the other witnesses come forward.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Wagner, good morning, and welcome back to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And if you'll put yourself on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Chip Wagoner. I serve as the executive director of the Alaska Conference of Catholic Bishops, formerly known as the Alaska Catholic Conference. Two bills before you, House Bill 101 and House Bill 148, are fairly simple bills. One is only 23 lines long, and the other is only 17 lines long. Both bills, however, contain within them a huge principle of Catholic social doctrine. The principle is that each and every person has human dignity deserving of recognition and reverence. Each person is willed by God, each is imprinted with God's image, and each is a reflection of God's presence in the world. During Vatican II, 41 years ago, the Church issued the document Pastoral Constitution on the church in the modern world. There we stated, there is growing awareness of the sublime dignity of human persons who stand above all things and whose rights and duties are universal and inviolable. They ought, therefore, to have ready access to all that is necessary for living a genuinely human life, for example, food, clothing, housing, the right to work, and the right to education. Sadly, this is not the case in much of the world. Half of the world lives on less than $2 a day. 1 billion people live in urban slums. 30 million people die yearly from hunger or from diseases related to hunger. People in desperate straits are vulnerable, not only from the lack of necessities, but from those who would prey upon them due to their vulnerabilities. Women and children are especially vulnerable. Each year, the Vatican issues an annual report on children. The most recent report issued this past January noted that more than 800 million children around the world are victims of malnutrition, disease, trafficking, and other forms of economic and social exploitation. More than 50 million children are born each year that are never even registered, leaving them open to a lifetime of exploitation as they are unknown of their existence by even their own governments. Human trafficking involves more than 1 million children each year in what has become a $1.2 billion business and a growing phenomenon, particularly, I might add, in Europe. It has been stated that after drug dealing, human trafficking is tied with the illegal arms industry as the second largest criminal activity in the world today and the fastest growing. Now, we must recognize, however, that drugs and illegal arms are mere commodities. Human beings are being trafficked as commodities, and they are people like you and me. One might argue that trafficking in humans is a problem over there and not here. The Catholic response in a century of social teaching is, and I'll quote, "We are one human family, whatever our national, racial, ethnic, economic, and ideological differences. We are our brothers and sisters' keepers," citing Genesis chapter 4, number 9. In a linked and limited world, our responsibilities to one another cross national and other boundaries. Violent conflict and the denial of dignity and rights to people anywhere on the globe diminish each of us. This is a doctrine of Catholic social doctrine that we call solidarity. While human trafficking is a worldwide issue, it is a problem in this country as well. The United States Department of State estimates that 18,000 to 20,000 victims are trafficked across U.S. borders each year. The Center for Women Policy Studies and their president testified last year before the House Judiciary Committee. They believe the number is much closer to 100,000. Now, the bills before you represent first steps to combat human trafficking in Alaska by making promoting sex tourism a crime and by making human trafficking a crime. The Alaska Conference of Catholic Bishops supports both bills. More can and should be done, however. For example, California in September recently passed a comprehensive 28-page bill that, among other objectives, enables a victim of human trafficking to bring a civil action for actual damages. During its last legislature in 2004, Connecticut adopted a statute that created an interagency task force on the trafficking of persons that has been held up as a model for this type of legislation. We would support such future actions here in Alaska. We further would support efforts to encourage victims to come forward without fear of deportation. And I might do a sidebar here and state that there's a vast difference between illegal immigration, where people are coming across the borders on their own free will, versus people that are brought here against their will or brought here on the basis of false promises. These people should not be subject to a fear of being sent right back to the horrible situation that brought them here in the first place simply by not wanting to report the crime of human trafficking. Finally, we would support efforts and funding on behalf of victims, not only in the criminal justice context, but also in the social services context. Mr. Chairman, I thank you and I thank the members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. We'd like to get a copy of your testimony, since it's written, if you would, to Mr. Hove for the record. Questions for Mr. Wagner? Seeing none, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
Other folks that would like to testify on this bill this morning? In the audience? And do we have someone online? No one online this morning? Discussion with the members.
Mr.
Senator Guess.
I actually had two questions for the sponsor. If she wouldn't mind coming
Representative
back.
Representative Petula, could we have you grace
Thank you.
Us again?
Representative Petula, the human trafficking in the second degree, can you walk through an example of that? I can, the first degree I can read and kind of understand, but if the person obtains a benefit from commission with reckless disregard that the benefit just...
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess we did have planned people online, but since that didn't happen, I'll just go right ahead. So
there'll still be opportunity, I'm sure.
Thank you. In the criminal laws, as you know, there are different states of mind for people, intentional, negligent, reckless, knowingly. And what we did is we sought to separate the severity of the punishment along those lines. If someone has knowingly or intentionally committed the crime, they really knew what they were doing. They brought women or children into Alaska for this purposes of trafficking, then they're going to be more severely punished, Class A felony. But the second drop down is when the person, for instance, someone who owns a strip club, that's the example that has happened in Alaska, really, you know, saw very young women being brought in, let's say from the Ukraine, didn't speak any English. He could tell that the people were being held hostage, basically, and chose to sort of ignore what was going on. That's the second level. That's the recklessness, that the person, you know, had every reason to know and really sort of avoided what was happening. And so we thought that under that situation, the person should be prosecuted as well. So it's a lesser crime, lesser punishment, but we still wanted to criminalize that behavior because it's unacceptable behavior. So that's the distinction between the two levels.
Thank you. Can you comment on something that Chip had said about the fear of deportation? Can we do anything at the state level, or is that only can be resolved at the federal level?
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman. The federal government is addressing that, and it is really a federal question. Luckily, the next stage of development in anti-trafficking on the federal level has included special visas that women who are victims of trafficking can apply for. But he's also touched on sort of the heart of what trafficking is about. It's that fear of being held hostage, not being able to get home, not speaking the language, and that's really right at the heart of it. So the federal law has started to recognize that and try to work with the victims. He's also mentioned the necessity to really have a broader ambit for this, to be able to work with the victims through the social services, be able to know that simply because someone hasn't come forward, you know, in their own countries, many of these women face problems with the police, with the government itself. So there's a great fear of doing that, not knowing how to, you know, what would happen here if they did come forward. But we felt that this was sort of the first step, the criminal law step, and that then we would try to branch out into either task forces or the social services. Anchorage has a federal grant right now to be able to do work on this issue. I think it's almost $500,000 to be able to do work toward that. I see Ms. Carpinetti just made it in, so you might want to invite her up either on this bill or on 101. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Well, go ahead, Senator.
Thank you.
And Representative, I'm going to assume that your answers are through the chair, so you can have an open dialogue.
Thank you.
And it's actually a question for the committee to think about. We will, on page 2, line 5, we'll need to change the effective date just from one to the other. And I would think that we should consider an immediate effective date. If this becomes law, I don't think we want any time between where someone couldn't get prosecuted just because we decided to give it 90 days. But I'll let the sponsor get back to us if there's any reason for the delay.
That's a good point. Further questions for the bill sponsor at this time? Thank you very much. Ms. Carpignetti, welcome. Plane was a little late. Can we put you right to work?
Our favorite topic.
We have two bills that we're looking at. We're kind of flip-flopping between the two, House Bill 101 and House Bill 148. And we can give you a little time, take a short recess if you'd like to get prepared. Let's take a three-minute recess. Call the meeting back to order. And Ms. Carpignetti, welcome back to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Thank you.
And if you'll put yourself on the record, we would like to ask a couple of questions.
My name is Annie Carpignetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Ms. Carpignetti, as we've given you just a few minutes to get briefed up on, we're looking at two bills right now at the same time, but we'd like to have your comments. We have in front of us Department of Law Draft A on House Bill 101. And I think the members are trying to compare version F.A that came over to us from the House to your draft, and we couldn't force Representative Cross into showing a preference, so we were wondering if maybe you could tell us the rationale behind your draft.
The rationale for our suggestion was it's a little bit tighter, a little narrower. We were concerned that promoting travel for the purpose of another person engaging in acts of prostitution might cover activity that we weren't really looking to cover. For example, the cab driver who picks somebody up at the airport and takes them to a place where the cab driver knows commercial sex might be available. For that reason, we thought a narrower definition would be advisable, at least at first. That was the reason.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Carpignetti? Senator, yes.
Yes. Can you point to anywhere else between the languages that there would be an intent difference between the languages, between 101 and the suggested language from law? You had said the promotes travel and that would narrow that in the examples. Is there any other places, or in your mind, do they do the same things except for kind of that section?
Oh, you mean A2?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think the culpable mental state is knowing in all of them, for example, in paragraph A1, sells or otherwise advertises travel services or facilitates travel, which would be a cab driver, to for the purpose of another person engaging in an act. In paragraph 1, paragraph 2, suffers from the same problem. For the purpose of is pretty broad. There could be other purposes. You know, somebody might just want to be taking a ride for a cab driver, which I don't know whether Representative Croft wants to cover. I think he may want to. We may want Department of Law maybe a little bit more cautious in wanting to make that activity a crime.
Representative Croft, would you take the other chair, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I think on reflection to the extent the committee is interested, do prefer the Department of Law's language as tighter. You get wedded to what you originally started with, but with the reflection of the interim, I think it is much more clear as to what we're criminalizing. I think the two examples that sort of flesh it out for me in the simple way my mind works is sort of a Thai Air example or a taxi cab example. If an airline is simply providing travel services and that is for the purpose of another engaging. It was not my intent to get a airline or any other transportation service that was simply transporting somebody, not doing it, advertising it for that purpose, not doing it with that explicit purpose, but maybe somewhere along the way knowing that they were going for that purpose. I wouldn't want to cast the net so far. And in the taxi cab example, it does seem to me that them simply providing travel services that end up at a place where that might be available, it's problematic criminalizing it, or at least tricky. I would hope that we would be able to in our prostitution laws, if somebody gets off a plane and says to the taxi cab driver, where can somebody get sex in this town, and the driver responds to that and takes them there, that we could criminalize that under our general facilitating prostitution crimes. But I don't want this to be so broad that it's problematic, and I think as enticement for the travel, we're all very clear on what we're doing. So it's a question of being overbroad or too narrow. My original worry was that the Department of Law's draft was too narrow. I think it more precisely says what we want to do and gives us less trouble.
That brings me to the question then. In your version, Representative Croft, we have a new crime, the crime of promoting sex tourism. And in Ms. Carpinetti's draft, it is committing the crime of promoting prostitution in the second degree, which I assume is already a crime under Alaska statutes. Is that correct?
I'll check the penalty right now.
So in that regard, could I ask what the penalties would be in comparability here?
Right. She's checking now, but I'll go out on a limb. Well, be more prudent to wait. I believe when we discussed this before, she put it in an area where it's the same penalty, that it's a Class
C felony.
Okay.
Should have waited 10 more.
So the penalties are exactly the same. Is there any reason that either one of you would advocate for one position or the other, the separate crime or utilizing the crime that's already on the statutes now?
I both think, Mr. Chairman, that the enticement language is cleaner, and all things being equal, it's cleaner to put it within an existing crime than define a whole new one.
It's kind of been the direction that the Senate Judiciary Committee has taken, is to use the current statutes rather than creating new crimes, if we could.
Probably wise.
Yeah. Now, I noticed when we were in recess that Senator French may have a differing opinion than that, but Senator French?
I think I've been won over by the excellent arguments of Ms. Carpinetti and the observations of Representative Croft.
All right. Well, you both won on that one. Okay, further questions for either of our Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess McDonald's and a cup of coffee come to question about how far-reaching litigation can come. And in this case, Representative Croft, you talked about the airlines. What I would hate to see is that we get that same stretch where Alaska Airlines, based on two groups of females flying to the U.S. from, you name where the point of departure was, and suddenly the answer was, but you should have known after twice. My question for you is there an implication for Alaska Airlines or other kinds of airlines have some liability factor based on the scenarios we're talking about?
Senator Huggins, because it's a criminal statute, it wouldn't be liability. Of course, it would be
criminal.
Well, I understand. Yeah. I think the switch that we've discussed here today takes care of that. They would have to provide, to offer, sell, advertise, essentially going through all those verbs, advertise the travel with the sexual conduct as enticement for.
So we know that Alaska Airlines has package deals to Mexico, to Cabo San Lucas. It includes airline travel, the hotel room, a few other things. If they throw in a prostitute, they violated the law.
They can advertise that Cabo San Lucas trip, and people can go and do all the other things and sexual conduct, and if they didn't And what they cannot do under this law is say, and come for the commercial sex in Cabo San Lucas.
Right.
That would violate it. Providing the travel without that as enticement would not.
But there's nothing in the law that if they flew someone to an area of known sexual activity that they would be guilty of any statute in Alaska statutes.
Not our intent, and I think the new draft is much more precise
okay.
in making sure that happens.
Have we discussed this sufficiently? Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Further questions? For the testimony from anyone? We haven't seen any other testimony show up on either bill, have we? Open for discussion for on the members on 101 at this point. We'll probably carry it over for a vote and allow us, but I don't, either way, but shall we amend it? Shall we, the chair would entertain an amendment here, I guess, to substitute the language of draft A for the language included in version F, Foxtrot dot alpha.
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman, and I'll move that we consider draft Department of Law draft A to HB 101 essentially in lieu of the original bill.
So since it hasn't been proposed as a committee substitute, we will we'll just amend version FW.A strike the language in FA and replace it with the language in Department of Law draft A. Is there objection? Hearing none, that amendment is adopted. And for further discussion at this point,
Mr. Chair.
Senator French, yes. Keep wanting to call you Senator French for some reason.
We look alike.
Yeah.
It's the new beard that has thrown me off.
I don't think that helps.
I won't take that.
Careful.
Personally.
I know.
Yeah. I'd like to move on House Bill 101 that we put an immediate effective date.
Okay.
It seems to be another one where I don't see a reason for not having it and would hate to miss a situation where.
Amendment number 2 by Senator Guess is to include in the language an immediate effective date. Is there objection? Amendment number 2 is adopted. Any other amendments? Seeing none, we will we'll get this version cleaned up as amended, and bring it back for opportunity for anyone else to testify and a vote of the committee. And so let's go next to House Bill 148. Ms. Carpinetti, did you have any comments on House Bill 148?
Well, only that we have worked with the representative.
Could you just come up?
Support the bill and
just put it on the record for me.
Again, this is Annie Carpinetti. I work for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. We have worked with Representative Krutula very cooperatively on this bill, and we support it in its current form.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Carpinetti on House Bill 148? I want to give our members the opportunity to ask questions to the Department of Law. Seeing none, is there any other testimony on 148? All right. Ms. Krutula, we'll notify you when we bring it back into committee for you to have an opportunity for other people to testify if they'd like to. And we do appreciate your bringing
Thank
it
you,
to
Mr.
us this
Chair.
Morning.
Thank you.
You bet.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clean
Senator
at this
Guess.
Time, I'd like to move on page 2, line 5, that we change the effective date from the current effective date of July of last year to an immediate effective date.
Senator Guess has moved amendment number 1, which would make the effective date immediate. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 1 is adopted. Any further amendments? Seeing none, it is now 15 minutes after the hour of 10 a.m., and is there any other business to bring before the committee this morning? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.